America's Web Radio. It's time now for Medicine on Call, and we've got Dr. George sliding into second base or first base or something, and her guest is on the line from Buffalo, New York. And I had a brief moment to talk to him, Dr. George, and he is one of the few doctors that is really supporting your president.
That's a wake-up call, isn't it? Good morning, Dr. Huntoon. This is just a pleasure to have you back on the show today. Dr. Huntoon is the editor of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons Journal, and also, well, you're the past president of the AAPS too, are you not? Excellent. If you'd be so kind, just to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. I know you've been on before, but there may be some new people who don't know about you.
Well, I am a member of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, which is an organization that's existed since 1943, and the main purpose of our organization is to support the patient-physician relationship, particularly to protect it from third-party intrusion. I'm a practicing neurologist. I run a third-party free practice just outside of Buffalo, New York, and by third-party free, I mean that I don't agree to ration care by signing up with insurance companies or by signing up with Medicare and other government programs. So I've opted out of Medicare, and I do not have any insurance contract which would pose a conflict of interest.
I absolutely love that. I think what you just said should be the template for all physicians in this country. And, you know, our topic today is one that's very dear to my heart, because I see my time, it's like an hourglass, you know, of being a physician in this country. It's like it's slipping away, because there's all sorts of horrible things encroaching on the medical profession. Anything, you just mentioned two of them, Medicare and third-party insurance, but we're talking now about the Justice Department, about our own specialty and medical associations like the AMA, like for me, the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. All of these organizations that are supposed to be protecting us seem to be working against us. And you wrote an excellent research article. It's entitled Sham Peer Review, The Psychology of Obedience and Social Influence. And that's one of the major questions I always ask as a physician, and I want to know what your take is, and I think you're going to be able to tell us in great detail in a few minutes. Why is it? What happened to doctors that they would allow themselves as a group to be completely enslaved by a system that works against the doctor-patient relationship, against us as professionals and as human beings? How could that even happen? I mean, I would think that, I mean, I'm sitting here going, I can't believe this is happening. Every day something passes. But what's the mindset of our colleagues?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the training of physicians. If you look at the training of physicians and contrast it with the training of lawyers, for instance, physicians are basically trained to go along with things, to sort of have a herd mentality, to not be confrontational, to be appeasing, and to accept whatever sort of befalls them. Whereas lawyers, on the other hand, their whole training is basically focused on confrontation, because they will be working in an adversarial system where confrontation is needed and valued. So a lot of it has to do, I think, with the training of physicians that sort of make a lot of physicians apathetic and unwilling to fight back when they're being oppressed.
Well, what about the Hippocratic Oath? I mean, that's something that at least I think all of us have taken. I've had stories now that some medical schools don't apply it. But that should be the thing, the preeminent thing. Do no harm and be an advocate for your patient no matter what. How does that jibe with being a sheep?
Well, I think physicians kind of compartmentalize that. And when we look at the third-party system, where insurance companies are responsible for paying the bill or government's responsible for paying the bill, the physician really isn't responsible to the patient anymore. And if you look at what medical schools are teaching and what maintenance of certification requires, it's a systems-based care. Mm-hmm. That is care that is best for the most people in the system. Well, that's totally the opposite of what the Oath of Hippocrates is about, which is serving individual patients one at a time to the best of your ability.
That's an excellent point. So you're talking about collectivism in medicine, basically.
Absolutely, and that's very bad for patients.
It's bad for everybody in every aspect of our society. One size fits all, conveyor belt, and the good of the many outweigh the needs of the few. But in this instance, when you talk about collectivism, and I'm seeing a trend here, it's not about the good of the many. It's about the good of the select, of the cronies, of the friends, and of the people in power. That's how I'm seeing it. Do you see it the same way?
I absolutely see it the same way. It's about maintaining the bureaucratic structure and, in some cases, maintaining the revenue stream of entities that are sort of forcing bad things upon us.
Mm. You mentioned briefly about maintenance of certification, and I know my listeners have no idea what that is. You know, I think most doctors actually don't know what that is and what's coming down the pipe. Give us a little history on how you think this has come about and what the point of this is.
Well, most patients have heard the term board certified. And in a physician's career, what it used to be is you would go through medical school, internship, residency, possibly fellowship. You would get out and take a board examination, which usually was quite rigorous, oftentimes included both a written exam and an oral exam, and the physician would become board certified. That used to be a lifetime certificate. That is, once you reach that hurdle, you're board certified for life. However, some of the specialty boards, going back a number of decades, I think family practice was among the first, started adopting the concept that, well, no, once you're board certified, we have to recertify you over and over and over again. And that then morphed into what is now known as maintenance of certification, which is a very onerous, time-consuming, expensive process that physicians have to go through on an ongoing basis to maintain their certification status. So it's something that's going to affect a lot of physicians, particularly younger physicians, and eventually it may affect older physicians with lifetime certificates.
I'm one of those older ones with lifetime board certification, and it has been a really pleasurable thing to recredential and say I don't have to recertify because I've passed the first time I took it. And so you're telling me that this is going, once we let this horse out of the barn, it's going to be, they're going to grandfather backwards, basically, and say, forget what we said, now you have to recredential, even though you didn't before. Am I correct?
Right, and the way that's going to happen is not through the specialty boards, but through the medical boards of each state.
What?
The Federation of State Medical Boards, which is sort of an umbrella organization of all the medical boards, each in every state, is going to try and implement what's known as maintenance of licensure, which will make maintenance of certification or its equivalent mandatory in every single state. So that's what's going on now. They're trying to implement this in certain pilot states, and so far, fortunately, they've failed.
Which states have they tried to do this in?
Well, they tried to do it in Ohio, which was one of the pilot states. And the Ohio physician stood up and said, no, we're not going to take this anymore, and they passed a resolution at their state medical society that said, we don't support this. We're going to oppose new maintenance of licensure requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the medical board in Ohio basically rescinded its plan to implement maintenance of licensure in that state. Now, it's likely going to come back again, as bad ideas usually do.
Yeah.
But at least physicians are standing up and saying, no, you know, this isn't good for medicine, it's not good for physicians, and it's not good for patients.
So who's, you know, I'm now curious, who makes up one of these types of medical boards? Are they physicians? Are they bureaucrats? What are these people?
Well, they are usually physicians and lay people, and frequently they're appointed by the governor of the state. So these are politically appointed positions.
That's horrible. So they're getting paid to basically put their foot on the necks collectively of doctors in their state.
Right. And some medical boards, for example, have a lawyer as their executive director.
Oh, my God. That's like Fox in the Hen House, huh? They must have a party with this thing. I can't believe
you said it better.
I'm disgusted. I really am. I had no idea how well organized and mercenary this thing really is. I was thinking it was coming from the specialty boards nationally, but this is just awful.
Well, so, you always have to follow the money. If you follow the money, that sort of tells the story. And what we have here is an almost incestuous relationship between various entities, one scratching the back of the other, so as to enhance the revenue stream of both at the expense of physicians. So specialty boards, for example, of which there are many, they send a substantial sum to fund the American Board of Medical Specialties, the umbrella organization, which in turn turns around and lobbies the specialty boards to mandate maintenance of certification. Likewise, the state medical boards, which send some of their money that they get from licenses to the Federation of State Medical Boards, again, an umbrella organization, that turns around and lobbies the state medical boards for implementing maintenance of licensure requirements. So all of these entities, basically, if you look at it, they're acting in their own profitable self-interest in doing these things at the expense of practicing physicians.
Wow. Isn't that, I mean, that should be illegal, frankly. It's like
Well, it's definitely a conflict of interest that, you know, shouldn't be allowed, but, you know, some of the heads of these various umbrella organizations are making huge salaries, some on the order of about $1 million a year.
On top of everything else, just
right. Oh,
mad
yeah, that's
money.
Right. 2009, for example, if you look at the GuideStar.org website, which is a place you can go to find out what the revenue stream is of these nonprofit tax-exempt organizations and what they pay their top executives. Mm-hmm. In 2009, for example, on that website it says the executive director of the American Board of Internal Medicine had a total compensation package in excess of $860,000 a year for a 35-hour work week.
What?
That's pretty good for a part-time work.
Yeah, that's great. That's like athlete salaries. That's amazing. I'm floored. So we're talking about everybody scamming on doctors, and the doctors actually the lowest on the totem pole, just trying to see their patients, and God forbid keep a private practice open and not be, you know, sucked into the hospital system.
And as you said, it's come to the point where you see, as a physician, more and more of your time being taken away to have to comply with all these things that are coming at physicians, and that takes a lot of time away from treating patients and physicians spending time with his family.
Now, you know, do you have any idea about how much it costs? And is this every year you have to maintain the maintenance of certification, or does it roll? Are you familiar with the how onerous this is on a ground level point?
Well, it's horribly onerous, and of course, different specialty boards have a little different time schedule. Some, the maintenance of certification or recertification part of it is done like every 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. Others have a 10-year cycle. But there's basically four components to this maintenance of certification. Part one, which is professional standing, which just means that you have you possess a unrestricted medical license. Part two, which is lifelong learning, is extremely onerous. It involves 25 continuing medical education modules and 2 self-assessment modules per year over a 10-year cycle. So that's an ongoing thing. Then there's part three, which is the cognitive examination, where you sit for a written examination. That's every 7 to 10 years. And then there's part four, which is known as performance in practice or practice quality improvement. That involves conducting peer assessment surveys, chart reviews, where your care is compared to peers and national benchmarks. And so you have to provide data to these specialty boards on an ongoing basis. You have to develop a written plan for improvement. You have to show that you implemented the plan for improvement, and you have to compile the data to show the results of your plan implementation. You also have to conduct patient surveys, and you also have to demonstrate that you're meeting systems-based care goals. So that's just sort of an outline of the things that physicians have to do in this maintenance of certification process. Very time-consuming, very onerous, and it's expensive.
And so I assume every module you've got to pay something in, correct?
Yes.
We're talking hundreds? Are we talking thousands?
Well, it's thousands.
Thousands? Oh, my gosh. That's awful. I mean, who could afford to pay this?
And a lot of physicians that have gone through this. And understand, when you go into these written examinations, I'm told that you are fingerprinted. You're not allowed to take in even a Kleenex or a handkerchief. No anything that you can take in or take out of that examination.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you're treated like a criminal, more or less.
This is, on that note, let's please take a break and recover. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that using Q-tips can cause chronic ear itching? Q-tips remove natural oils that prevent skin from becoming dry and itchy. They also promote wax blockage that can cause hearing loss and infection. Instead of using Q-tips, use alcohol drops. Put 2 to 3 drops of alcohol in the ear and let stand for about 30 seconds, then let the alcohol drain out. This will not only control itching, but it will also decrease the risk of external ear infections, also known as swimmer's ear. To prevent swimmer's ear, the drops should be used after any water exposure, including swimming and showering. If you have a history of ear infections, a history of ear surgery, or if you have pain or bleeding from your ear, you should see a doctor prior to using the alcohol drops. Please join me on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Moms, dads, listen to my radio program, Homeschooling for Today, on Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you'll learn all about how to homeschool on America's Web Radio.
Have you heard of quantitative fluid analysis? Commonly called QFA, this test assesses your body at a cellular level and gives insight into your illness. Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center offers the QFA, an FDA-approved test that can often provide early diagnosis of conditions before they can be detected with other tests. Dr. Elena George believes in an integrative approach to medicine. She believes in treating the problem and not the symptom. Following a review of your results, Dr. George will suggest treatment approaches such as nutritional counseling and or the use of pharmaceutical-grade enzymes and nutritional supplements. Surgery and prescription medication will be recommended only when necessary. Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road Northwest in Suite 260 North Tower, 2 blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. Call their office at 404-591-9100 to make an appointment and mention that you heard this ad on Radio Sandy Springs and get 10% off of QFA testing.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're talking today with Dr. Larry Huntoon, the editor of the American Association of Physician Surgeons Journal and also the chairman of the AAPS Committee to Combat Sham Peer Review. And before the break, we were talking about, you know, the indoctrination and the enslavement of doctors to a system that is going to doom them to just keep taking tests, keep them demoralized, in my opinion, and financially on the hook in order to maintain the ability to practice medicine. This is, you know, I see this as a psyops, quite frankly, where not only are we being indoctrinated in school to just become a drone in a system that's just evidence-based, quote-unquote, but those of us who are free-thinking, really care about our patients, are now in a position of if you want to practice, you're going to do it our way or you won't do it at all. Is that what's going on?
That's exactly what's going on. In fact, when you take an exam, if you take an examination, one of these maintenance of certification written exams in your specialty, you're going to find that many of the questions are totally irrelevant to your specific practice of medicine. So, for example, a spine surgeon who just operates on spines may have to answer a lot of questions about the latest techniques in hip replacement surgery, for example. And if you don't get those right, guess what? You're going to lose your board certification status. And if maintenance of licensure requirements go through, you'll lose your medical license.
I don't think no other profession in this country or, you know, is subjected to this type of harassment. Taking fingerprints, this is not just maintenance of certification. I find that just to get licensed in states now, you have to give fingerprints. I'm surprised there's no other biometric that's going to be used. I mean, I shouldn't speak because there may be other things coming down the pipe. Drug testing, having a background check. I mean, you're like going through basically a TSA plus security check in order to practice medicine. And that seems to be pervading the system. What I'm now looking at, I don't know if you're seeing this too, but this vaccination kick that the hospitals are on. but you can't practice medicine unless you get a shot. Is that part of this whole grid that we're being subjected to, too?
Well, yeah, and in that case, what we're talking about is mandatory vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone's opposed to vaccinations in general. There may be some, but I think a lot of us are in favor of vaccinations that have been helpful. But what we're not in favor of is making any medical treatment, whether it's surgery, treatment with pills, or vaccinations, making that mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
If we look back in history, that was one of the focuses in the Nuremberg trials following World War II. That's where the informed consent concept sort of came into being, that you don't do things and force things on people without their informed consent. But we have today hospitals that are forcing flu vaccinations, for example, on all of their personnel and medical staff, or if they don't comply with that, they're fired. And in the very next issue of our journal, we're going to have an article written by a nurse who worked for 22 years at a hospital in Indiana, and she was summarily fired
mm-hmm.
because it was determined her religious exemption to the receiving the flu vaccination was not good enough to satisfy the hospital, and they fired her because she didn't take the flu vaccination. So that's 22 years of skill down the drain just because the nurse didn't agree to inject her body with a vaccination.
Oh, I can absolutely agree with that. I credentialed at a hospital recently who required flu shots, and I wrote I said I had a religious, objection to it, and they said that wasn't good enough. I needed to be more specific. So I was more specific, and I gave them documented, studies on why it's unsafe, et cetera, and they finally accepted it. But, it's like what your personal ethics are and morals, it doesn't count. You are
isn't it horribly arrogant?
Yes,
that
it
someone
is.
Should sit in judgment of you
yeah.
regarding your religious beliefs or moral beliefs.
It's pretty
someone
amazing.
Judging you if those are good enough or not. To me, that's outrageous.
To me, that's the latest salvo. I remember reading an article that AAPS, they had a conference call a while back about a physician who, I don't know if it was a lawyer or somebody else, questioned his operative note. They're going to tell him what he meant to say and what he did in his surgery when he was there and he dictated the report. So not only do our words now no longer mean anything, but someone's going to tell us what we meant when we tell you what we did in a surgery or a procedure. That's
right.
Really over the top.
You better be careful what you put in your operative reports as a surgeon, because this surgeon was not convicted of any Medicare billing fraud, but he was convicted of making a misstatement in his operative report or something the government said was a misstatement. And as a result of that misstatement in a single operative report, he is now serving time in federal prison. And this doctor brought in experts.
Mm-hmm.
Some physicians where he trained that said, this is the way we report this particular procedure. When we did it at our institution, it's perfectly proper. But the government, if they disagree, they can throw you in prison for simply stating it in a way that the government doesn't approve of in your own operative report.
So you wonder where is it stops then. So you're now talking about compartmentalized, top-down medicine where the government now, at this point, they're deciding what gets paid. Anybody, my mantra is whoever controls the purse strings controls everything. That's the bottom line, and I will stand by that. So now the government's saying if you fall in the hospital, the patient falls out of bed or slips and falls, the hospital won't get paid. I love this new one, which is if you have a patient post-op and they get a post-operative infection, that should never happen, and the hospital won't be paid. So we have these ridiculous pronouncements by pencil pushers telling you how medicine should go. Not realizing, not caring that medicine is not just a science, it's an art. And you can't just have a top-down, pronouncement and everything happens that way.
And have you ever noticed the pattern and the theme is always the same? It's always some reason not to pay whatever was done.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's what they call the correct coding initiative, where they started bundling all different sorts of separate procedures into a single procedure
mm-hmm.
so that the government didn't have to pay for individually separate procedures. The theme is the same. They're looking for more and more ways simply to not pay for work done.
Well, if you listen, I actually didn't watch it, but I've read some excerpts of the State of the Union last night, and the mention about Medicare was, we should not pay for procedures done, the number of procedures done, or the time the patient spends in the hospital. We should pay for the quality of care. Well, what does that mean? That means if you get an infection, you know, you come in, you're septic, and you end up getting a post-operative infection, you won't be paid. It's all these things that they're not going to do, have nothing to do, and actually work against patient care that they're trying to push through. And, I mean, we need, as a group, and I know AAPS is one of the premier organizations doing it, but we need to get out to the people, because I know what's going to happen. You and I both know how the media spin is going to happen with this maintenance of certification thing. Don't you want to go to a doctor who's maintaining their certification, how wonderful that is, and it's going to be people deciding, like they do always, if the government says it's good, then it must be. And what they're really signing up for is for all the good people to leave the profession and to have the least experienced and the least trained people in the system. How do we go about educating people so they don't fall into this trap?
Well, I think we have to start by pointing out the hypocrisy in this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all this maintenance of certification and maintenance of licensure is supposedly being proposed because we need to make sure that physicians are competent over their career as far as what they're doing. But what's happened in our system? A lot of times, patients don't even get to see a real doctor anymore. They see a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner. Are those individuals participating in maintenance of certification?
No.
Of course not.
No.
They aren't certified in anything, let alone participating in maintenance of certification. It gets worse. If you look at the president and CEO of some of these organizations, notably the Federation of State Medical Boards and the American Board of Medical Specialties, they themselves, although they promote doing all these things, they don't participate in maintenance of certification. And you can look this up by simply going to those websites, finding out who the president and CEO is, then going to their specialty board and finding out what their certification status is. I mean, isn't that egregious? These are the leaders who are forcing this mandatory maintenance of certification and maintenance of licensure on physicians, but they themselves don't participate in maintenance of certification.
Gee, you know, that's a big surprise. Doesn't that sound eerily similar to Congress, who passes laws and they don't apply to them?
That's right.
Can we talk about it? Obamacare doesn't apply to them. Insider trading doesn't apply to them. It's just incredible. This is a mafia system. That's what this is. It's complete mafia-driven. And patients and doctors and I think Americans in general are being they're being abused, balkanized, and actually just becoming fodder, grist for the mill, to just be taken advantage of, just like a tax base, ready to pay taxes but get nothing back. This is the same thing going on in medicine. Where's the outrage of the people who are, I guess we don't know. But how can we do something about that? That should stop immediately.
Well,
if it's good for you, it's good for me.
People are probably wondering, well, how does all this affect me? I'm not a doctor. I don't care about maintenance of certification and maintenance of licensure. But here's how it will affect patients. AAPS took a survey, and 68% of the physicians who responded said they are not going through this maintenance of certification process again. And physicians who are in the 55 to 65 and older age group are not going to go through this maintenance of certification process.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is they will retire early or they will simply quit medicine. And then you're going to have a real access to care problem for patients. So that's why patients should care about this.
I think that says it all. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that dizziness may be a sign of heart disease, iron deficiency, high or low blood pressure, low blood sugar, or an inner ear infection? Dizziness can take the form of a spinning sensation, also known as vertigo, or a feeling of lightheadedness. The individual can also feel faint or have a rapid heartbeat. If you take high blood pressure medication, remember to take the medication daily as directed to control your blood pressure. Diabetics must remember to eat after taking their medication and to eat at regular intervals. If you have anemia, make sure to take a multivitamin that contains iron and to eat vegetables such as spinach. Dizziness after a cold or flu may be due to a virus. If you have dizziness, it is important to see your doctor for a complete physical examination. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Hi, I'm Paisley McDonald, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, At Home with Paisley, every week, Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, for practical advice and stylish living for your home and office.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're talking today with Dr. Larry Huntoon, the chairman of AAPS Committee to Combat Sham Peer Review, and also the editor of the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons. You know, Dr. Huntoon, what you're talking about, what we've been talking about actually, is it's like a stamp. It's like the same process going along in every aspect of our society. Medicine is now the latest and actually the biggest. Is this going to affect the entire population? Even if you don't get sick, it's going to be like a vacuum sucking money out of your pocket. I understand Obamacare is going to cost $1.3 trillion to implement over the next, 10 years, maybe less than that, actually. And the cost to the government, over 50% of the government's cost is going to be used running Obamacare and its Medicare, Medicaid, its, legacy programs. What does that leave for the rest of the country if we're just a big old welfare state of people who are barely getting care by the least trained and the least knowledgeable?
Well, it will leave a lot of debt, for one. And it will leave poor and poor quality care as fewer and fewer physicians are actually treating patients.
I've noticed, too, that, I know that we're now coming to the second line, but I think talking with nurses who trained the old-fashioned nurses, who actually had clinical training, who worked collegially with doctors, so that it was a team, it wasn't nurses as the forefront, they're pretty much leaving their profession, too. And there's a big push towards case managers, pencil pusher type of positions where it's all about documenting and coding, but it's not about patient care. And the nurses coming out don't really have access to treating patients. They don't even know what they're doing. And they're being led by nurses' aides. I mean, that's really the front line. It's the folks who are watching TV, doing those 9-month programs for medical assistants and nursing assistants. They're the ones actually on the front line of patient care. They're the ones doing the vitals. They're the ones doing the contact with the patients. And that's really tragic, because if they don't know what an emergency is or what clinically they're supposed to be looking for, and the nurse is out there going through a chart, talking to the insurance company, and the doctors, if they're a private practitioner, they're not even allowed to see the patient sometimes in the hospital. We're talking about a total mess based on money.
I think a lot of nurses are very frustrated and disgusted with the fact that they're not able to spend time with patients. Instead, the hospitals are forcing them to play with these electronic tablets and electronic health systems to input data, most of which is really difficult to use as far as clinical information. But that's where a lot of the time's going, is they're playing with these electronic health systems, entering all the data they're supposed to be entering to show quality care. Meantime, they don't have much contact with patients.
Well, if they don't have contact with the patients, isn't that the whole point of going into a hospital, is actually getting care as opposed
to... supposed to be, but unfortunately, like you say, it's nurses' aides. And often it's physician assistants and nurse practitioners who are making rounds on the patients, not physicians.
I'm not sure they're rounding, to tell you the truth. I think that they're just, you know, you do your, I mean, not, when I'm talking rounding, I'm talking when I was a medical student, and you had the whole group with the attending, the medical student, the whole team, the nurse come in, and each patient, you discuss them at the bedside. That doesn't happen anymore. I'm not even sure that happens in teaching hospitals at this point. I mean, it's just mind-boggling how the profession could change within 15, 20 years so dramatically from being patient-driven, patient-centered, to being corporate-driven. Now, we talked a bit at the beginning about follow the money. I've read that, you know, this push toward, I mean, in my opinion, the push towards vaccination is money-driven because the government gives hospitals money based on how many of their staff they vaccinated, and the goal is 70 or 80% vaccination rate. So there's an economic incentive now. It's not because they care. It's not because they want to keep you healthy, because they want to get more money from the government.
Right. And if you think about it, I mean, it is about the money, but if you think about it, are they actually protecting patients from anything? Because even if you vaccinated 100% of the personnel in the hospital and the medical staff, you still have visitors coming in who may not be vaccinated, mm-hmm. and nobody checks them at the door as far as their vaccination status or makes them wear masks. So are you really protecting patients by imposing these mandatory vaccinations on people who have some moral belief or religious belief that they don't want it?
It's about control, and it's about follow the money. And ultimately, it's the only way that, I mean, I think they're actually putting their grit into major, major place here. We talked about the maintenance of certification, but the peer review side of this is just as onerous, and it makes sure that if you do care about you, if you're an outlier in the sense that you want to go the extra mile for your patient, you want to think something outside the box in terms of treatment regimen, they're going to smack you down there too, are they not?
They absolutely are. If you're innovative or thinking of something, as you say, outside of the box to improve patient care, you better keep it to yourself, because if you try and use that in a hospital setting, you're likely to be attacked by something called sham peer review, and your medical career can be ended.
So this is not just, it could be personal. From what I've read about, you know, your article was very well done, and I think people should do a search on Dr. Huntoon and Sharon Peer Review, and I'm sure you'll get a ton of his articles that come up. But the most recent one talks about the psychological aspect of this, and there's something called the Milgram experiment. If you can just let the listeners know about that, because I think that gets applied throughout society.
Right. Well, I had always wondered how it was that apparently normal physicians could sit in judgment of their peer physician and take totally false accusations or be manipulated so as to end the physician's career. How could seemingly normal doctors do that? So I sort of went back in time and investigated, and I found what's known as the Milgram experiment. And this was a study basically conducted about 50 years ago at Yale University. And some of your listeners may recall there was a study where people were put at a control panel that would control shocks given to another person and seated in another room. And the person administering the shocks was told, you know, look, if these people give the wrong answer, then each time they give the wrong answer, you up the voltage on the shock. And they looked at the willingness of people to do that. Now, of course, there were no real shocks. But it didn't matter. I mean, the shocks actually were labeled as going up to 450 volts, and there were normal-appearing people who would administer shocks as high as what they thought was 450 volts to people in another room just because they were told to do so. So it has a lot to do with the psychology of obedience and social influence.
And that goes along with everything. So you're doing something to a fellow human being. I mean, we can extrapolate this to, you know, the TSA body scanners, for example. You know, people are being led to like sheep through that, and the people administering it have no idea how dangerous it is, even to themselves, but they're going to toe the line and make sure it gets, you know, everybody's going to go through that because that's my job. And it's like this attitude is, you know, I'm just following orders. That's
right.
The attitude.
And they've even replicated this in the hospital setting, where all but one of 22 nurses flouted their hospital's procedure by obeying a phone order from an unknown doctor, not on staff, to administer an excessive amount of a drug which could have been potentially lethal had they actually done it. So the nurses just simply took the call, a person not on medical staff, against hospital protocol, and said, okay, yeah, I'll give it to the patient.
So I think the teaching point in this is if you expect somebody to take care of you, someone in position of power or authority, to care about you, then you're insane. Because if they're following rules that are crazy, that are detrimental, that are harmful, they're just going to continue to do it. This is a blind will we're talking about. And you're just putting yourself on the chopping block if you think that someone's going to really look at you as an individual and care about you. You better protect yourself, basically.
Right. And again, you have to follow the money. A lot of the physicians are working for some other third party, be it an insurance company or government. They're not really working for the patient, for the benefit of the patient any longer.
That's been the change, hasn't it? I mean, we've gone from being largely open up your shingle, solo practitioner, to group practice, to hospital employees, to government employees. It's not like you're running your own ship anymore, as a majority of medical professionals now coming out.
And that's by design, and that's a lot of what Obamacare hopes to promote, is Obamacare basically sets out to destroy the private practice of medicine. Solo and small group practices will no longer exist if Obamacare gets fully implemented the way they want it to be implemented, and fee-for-service medicine will be over. That means that patients and physicians are going to be subject to a global bundled payment system where a hospital, for example, gets one bundled payment and then parses out small amounts to physicians to care for patients.
Is that
like a feudal system?
Is that what accountable care organizations are?
That's what accountable care organizations are about, too. It's basically working on a global bundled payment type system as opposed to what's known as a fee-for-service system, which is what we have now.
So I can picture this. The hospital gets the lump sum. They take the lion's share because they're the hospital and they have the resources, quote-unquote. And then everybody else, it just takes a crumb. I mean, basically, you can't afford to leave it if you're a doctor because there's no way you're opening up your own private practice once it's obvious that if you do a procedure or you do see a patient, you're going to get so little money you could barely subsist on it without seeing 1,000 a day. So that stops that in its tracks, I would think.
Right. So the physicians become dependent on the government crumbs.
That is, you know what, there's a lot of things that happen to the medical profession, but to me that's the most tragic. This is the only profession, in my opinion, that it's about the individual. It's about individualized care for somebody. It's about using your brain and not being hurt, part of the groupthink. And they've managed to turn that on its head and go the opposite direction with it. It's really frightening, actually.
Yes, and in fact, they define that as quality, moving in the opposite direction from individual-based care to collective-based care is basically equated with quality medicine.
It's very Orwellian, isn't it? A lot of doublespeak going on. Well, from a patient perspective, you know, they're being told on the other flip side of this that they're going to be able to afford whatever under Obamacare and keep their doctor and keep their insurance if they like it. Turns out that the IRS, I think it was the IRS, yeah, it was, that stated that the average cost for a family of four for the bronze Obamacare, that's the lowest level, is going to be $20,000 a family. Right now, I think it's 12, or maybe tops would be 15 for a Cadillac plan. So you've now gone up $5,000 to $6,000, and you're going to definitely get less. Which part of that do people not get?
Well, they're still listening to the promise by the president. It's going to be more affordable. But everything that we see around us contradicts that. If you look at health insurance premiums right now, what's happening to them? Well, they're increasing all over the place. In some cases, double-digit increases in health insurance premiums. And the insurance companies are just trying to get out ahead of this because they know that caps on insurance premiums are coming, and they're trying to find some way to bolster themselves financially before it occurs. Even the Kaiser Health News just came out with an article recently that said that, you know, costs are increasing as far as health insurance premiums when we were told they would be decreasing.
Gee, what a surprise.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, they provide better quality care. They believe that excellent medical care is a right and not a privilege. They are concerned that the current economy has forced people to sacrifice their health. They have therefore reduced their prices to make it more affordable. They will continue to provide state-of-the-art care. They continue to believe that patient care counts above all else. Peachtree ENT Center, concierge medicine without the concierge price. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. Call their office at 404-591-9100 to make an appointment or for more information. They are located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road Northwest, Suite 260 North Tower, 2 blocks south of Piedmont Hospital.
Hi, this is Rhonda St. Dennis. Listen to my program, Homeschooling for Today, on Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that nasal stuffiness can cause snoring and decrease the amount of oxygen that your body receives? A decrease in oxygen to the brain can cause problems with memory and concentration, and in severe cases, it can cause stroke. A decrease in oxygen to the heart can lead to high blood pressure, and in severe cases, a heart attack. Nasal stuffiness can be caused by exposure to irritants such as dust, mold, pollution, and chemicals. It can also be caused by exposure to trees, grass, and certain foods such as corn, wheat, eggs, soy, milk, and various meats. Medical treatment with nasal sprays and/or antihistamines that don't cause drowsiness can alleviate the congestion. It is important not to use over-the-counter spray decongestants since they can be addictive and actually make breathing more difficult. See your doctor for a complete evaluation of your nose. Please join me on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call and our special guest, Dr. Larry Huntoon. Dr. Huntoon, you've given our listeners a lot to think about. I mean, I'm speechless. It's like, I think your method of getting out, opting out of this system is the way to go. But does that really, how did doctors do what you did? I know why you decided, but how did you go about getting rid of third-party payer, getting out of government insurance? It's like people learn helplessness. If they do something that's going to help themselves, people think badly of them and they won't be popular anymore, special. And that's just not what the case is. It's about doing what you're put on this earth to do, and that is to care for patients. Decide which is important.
I think physicians need to explain to patients that who you work for and who you're paid by is basically who you have to follow as far as the orders. So if it's an insurance company or government, you basically have to do what insurance companies and governments tell you to do or you won't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas physicians who have gotten away from that system work directly for the patient, work for the best interest of the patient. Now, I've never signed an insurance contract, and I've been out in practice since 1986.
Awesome.
Different physicians do it differently. Some physicians look at their very worst abusers in terms of insurance companies, and they drop those first, one at a time, then they go to the next until they're done with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as a result of a law passed in 1997, physicians now have the option of opting out of Medicare for a 2-year period, and again, you have to renew that every 2 years. But that means you work directly for Medicare patients as opposed to the increased rationing schemes which Medicare has imposed and is making physicians implement basically via the price-fixing system.
Now, you mentioned rationing, and the proponents of Obamacare and progressives are always of the mindset, oh, that'll never happen. You know, that's a right-wing talking point. I know it's true. But can you give us some real-world examples, in your opinion, of the rationing that's happening?
Yes, I can give you a real-world example in my practice. There's something called positional vertigo, which is a very common occurrence. You're an ENT physician. You're aware of this. But positional vertigo is something that affects a lot of patients, tends to affect patients as they grow older. And it is something that, as it turns out, there is a way to fix that, to essentially cure it 80% of the time. It's a procedure called the Canalip repositioning procedure. The problem is physicians who are in the Medicare system, either as participating or non-participating physicians, really can't provide that, because if they do provide that, Medicare has determined that that procedure is worth zero, and they will be paid zero if they take the time to diagnose that and treat it properly. So that's a form of rationing. They do it, Medicare and the government does it through the price-fixing system, and so that physicians in the system basically don't offer that. Mm-hmm. And the only way that patients can get that is by going to physicians who are out of the Medicare system if you're a Medicare patient. So that's a prime example. Another example of rationing coming within the Obamacare system is the Independent Payment Advisory Board. This is a group of 15 individuals who will be appointed by the president basically to ration care. And we don't know exactly which schemes they will adopt to do that, but we are aware that there has been one scheme called the Complete Lives System. The co-author was Ezekiel Emanuel, who is the brother of Rahm Emanuel. And if you look at the article that he published, past the age of 50, your chances of getting a medical treatment or intervention decline precipitously. They even have a means of assessing your social worthiness or worthfulness to society to determine if you get care or not. So people should be genuinely frightened about whenever you hear an independent payment advisory board that is not accountable to Congress or to the will of the people, and it's coming in Obamacare.
I think that to add on to that, that complete live system, it's also rationing for people below the age of 15. So it's like 15 to 50. And if you're, first you're going to do the senior
right.
citizens, then they're coming for the neonates. So people who think that it doesn't apply to them, if you do it to one group, people should know this. This shouldn't even be an argument or a statement that I'm making. Whatever you do to the least of us, it will happen to everyone. It's just waiting your turn until it hits you. That's really
exactly right. And we all grow older at some point.
We do.
All of us are going to be older than 50 years old.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess at that point, then we'll care, I suppose.
Yeah, then it's too late.
Now, speaking of physicians, did you follow the statements by Dr. Carson this past week or a week ago when he spoke at the prayer breakfast for the at the prayer breakfast and the statement he made about Obamacare and basically medicine in general? Did you hear that?
I did not, no.
Well, he made a statement about setting what he would do to try to change the healthcare system is to set everybody up at birth with a health savings account and then have it put into that pot as you tax-free, and as you get older, you just access your own money. So you carry your own health savings with you. You're not depending on anybody else to do it. Sometimes, I mean, if you're indigent, the government will pay into it. But basically, people are now going to be party to their own health care costs and therefore their own decisions. That's, you know, that's a really good idea, but it doesn't fix the other side of it, in my opinion, where you have someone deciding what gets paid for. So if your example was perfection, because I find that the government and insurance companies never pay for what works and what actually helps the patient. You know, the Kenilworth positioning procedure is one. For us in ENT, balloon sinuplasty is the thing that's come on online most recently, which is a fraction of the cost to the patient, better outcomes in most cases, faster recovery, and insurance companies, some of them won't pay for it. But they're deciding, and this is where I get really upset, people who aren't in the profession, who aren't physicians, are deciding what's important and what's valuable and what's medically worth treating. It shouldn't be their call at any point. It should be, you guys don't know what you're talking about, shut up. And we allow this to happen. Until I think we as physicians and patients stand up and say, we're not doing this anymore. I don't care what you think. I'm not buying into this scheme. I think this is going to continue.
You're right, and it's all about control, and what these bureaucrats are doing is cost containment. But why wouldn't you pay for a simple office procedure,
mm-hmm.
non-surgical procedure, that can cure an illness that basically causes many patients to fall and break bones? It cures that 80% of the time, and oftentimes patients never come back again because they don't need to. Why wouldn't you pay for something like that?
Well, you know, it's insane when you take that example. They won't pay for that, but they'll pay for disability because the patient can't work.
Oh, wait. Right.
What kind of mess is that? Does that make any sense to you? I mean, if they
no, but very little the government does these days makes any sense to me.
You took the words out of my mouth. If they would just get out of the way and let people, real people, run their lives, we would not be in positions that we're in right now.
Exactly.
On that note, tell us how we can, how my listeners can follow you, or if they want to read your articles, even contact you if you want, how can they do that?
Yes. Well, what I would do is I would refer you to two different websites. Our journal website is jpands.org, and I would also refer them to the AAPS website, which is aapsonline.org. And you can find lots of information about the various topics we've been discussing today, including the journal article.
And can patients actually, as non-physicians, join AAPS? Is that possible?
Absolutely. We encourage patients to join as associate members, and when you do that, you get our publications so you can kind of follow along and know what's going on, and particularly know what's happening and going to happen before others are willing to tell you about it.
Willing, I'm sure. It's, knowledge is power, is it not?
It is.
Well, I really want to thank you so much for coming on today. I love it when you come on. I learn just as much as my listeners do, and I really hope that you'll come back.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity. It's been my great pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.